I wasn't expecting the chairman this morning, but the chairman has just arrived. I want us to try to get started here. Mr. Chairman? We're just getting started. Go ahead. Just sit down.
I guess I better do that.
Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
Morning. Thank you, sir. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. Before we begin this morning's meeting, I want to take a few moments to reflect on the events of September the 11th of 2001 and to call your attention to some of the quiet heroism that did not get highlighted when we remember the events of that tragic day 7 years ago. I'm talking about the focus and dedication of our frontline employees who, in the midst of all the chaos, stayed focused on our mission to bring our customers home that day. Many of the members of the board and many of us in this room were not affiliated with Metro 7 years ago, and we may not be aware of what was going on behind the scenes. Let me take a minute to remind everyone of the courage that our workforce displayed on September the 11th, 2001. The Pentagon was struck by terrorists just as our rush hour was coming to a close, just after 9:30 a.m. Normally, many of our train and bus operators would have been preparing to finish their morning schedules and return trains and buses to their terminals. Instead, after the news of the attack and in the wake of so much confusion in the region, we kept our trains on the rails and our buses on the street. In effect, we went back to rush hour service. During that time, people in the streets were dazed. Streets were jam-packed with cars. Rumors and incomplete information ran rapid. Yet through it all, Metro Rail and Metro Bus kept running. No one walked off the job. Imagine being a bus operator and having to deal with the worst kind of congestion on the city streets. Or imagine being a train operator going back into Metro's tunnels time and time again, even though your first instinct was to go home to your family. The fact is that no frontline employees walked off the job that day. No train operators abandoned their trains. No bus operators walked away for the all the actions on the street. No transit operators abandoned their posts. No station managers left the kiosk. The people who cleaned the stations and maintained the buses and the trains, none of them gave up and walked away. There were plenty of reasons to walk away. Frankly, we dealt with bomb threats at Union Station. We shut down the Yellow Line Bridge because we were worried about a terrorist attack on that target. Some suggested that Metro close down to mitigate the risk of another attack, but we said no. We made a decision to keep the trains and buses running that day. We knew that we were a lifeline for our customers, and we were not going to abandon them. In the days and weeks after the attacks, we took extra steps to help our colleagues over at the Department of Defense to recover and rebuild. We opened early for a month so that the Pentagon could get their staff to work, and we took many steps to strengthen our security in the system. So as the Pentagon prepares today to unveil its memorial to honor those who died, I want to extend my condolences to the family of those who lost their lives at the Pentagon and in New York and in Pennsylvania. But I would also like to remind this region, and frankly the country, of how critical Metro was to bringing order to chaos that day. The image before you on the screen is displayed on signs at the Pentagon and at Pentagon City Station. And as people visit the memorial over the next few days, they mourn the loss of life. Perhaps they will also be filled with pride when they read about the courage of our Metro employees. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd now like just to move on to the presentation of the operations.
Thank you very much, Mr. Cato, for that moving statement on this important day.
I would just like to comment and acknowledge the recognition that you've made to the employees. I think too frequently concentrate on our challenges, and I think that day they really reflected commitment they have to the system, and it is when you're in a challenge of unknown certainty as to how you act is really the measure of who you are. And I really do think we should extend as a board same recognition as you've reflected there. Our Metro employees are like mine for our region, and we do respect that.
Well said.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We do have before us the approval of the agenda. Is there objection to approving the agenda? Hearing none, the agenda is approved. Is there a motion to approve the minutes as if read from July 10, 2008? It's been moved and seconded, moved by Mr. Linton, seconded by Mr. Giancola. Discussion on the minutes. Discussion. Hearing none, all those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed, no. The ayes have it. The minutes are approved. We can now go to our operational reports. Mr. Cato.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Francis will make the report this morning.
Good morning, Mr. Graham, members of the committee. I thought what I would do is give a year in review of FY08 in all the sections in operations. If we need any backup information, I have that behind in the appendices. But starting with rail operations, we achieved our on-time performance goal of 95% on two of our lines last year. We accepted 182 of the 184 6000 series vehicles, installing the grab handles in the 6000 series vehicles. I think we have to this point about 84 to 90 cars that have been installed, and some of you might have seen them if you have been on the 6000 series vehicle. Next slide. In bus operations, we achieved the mean distance between failure. Our goal was 6,300. We ended the year at 6,326. Completed integration of all the components on the bus on-time performance, which we'll talk about in the next couple of slides. Awarded the five-year procurement and design new color scheme. Commenced delivery on the NABI articulated buses. At this time, we have about 15 buses on property out of the 22. And installed the operator enclosure pilot program. We mentioned this to the committee a couple of months ago. I think this is, we're going into our last month of this enclosure pilot program, and once we do, I'll come back to the committee and let them know the results. Next slide. What you see in front of you is some of the systems integrated in building the steps for Metro's bus on-time performance. This is the first time in the history of Metro Bus that we have a comprehensive measuring system in place that would be an integral component in providing reliable service. Next slide. What you see in front of you now is the industry average, which we got from APTA. The industry average for the month of July was a low of 65 and the high of 75. Metro's average was 73.14%, and how we measure our on-time performance is the schedule versus actual arrival time. We use 2 minutes early or 7 minutes late. Next slide. As I mentioned in the beginning, this is steps. This is our first approach of getting our on-time performance, and we have already started to do some analysis. Miller Victoria and his team have already started to look at all the routes, get all the on-time performance measurements on those routes, and we're looking at it from all routes, AM, PM, midday, late night. Some of the things that we just wanted to share with you that we're going to be looking at now, we are going through a reorganization and restructuring, but looking at our bus dispatch center, there's some things that we have to do there to assist with the on-time performance. Coordinating a little bit better between the divisions and street supervision. That's something that we talked about, and Mr. Cato mentioned before about supervisors getting more involved in the street activities. Verifying the schedules to ensure that what we are have written down, that we are actually able to maintain. We're going to be out with our checkers and field personnel to make sure that we double check our schedules and make changes when need be. Yard pullouts. Is we have to get out of the yard first before we start anything. And one of the things that we're going to look at is an on-time pullout. So when operators come to the divisions, they will get on the bus and get out on time. communication specialist to track and monitor real time. This is one of the things that we're going to look at the bus control center. It's more of a fleet management process because we're going to take a look at all the routes and do some analysis on the whys and how comes. Similar to what you've seen in the rail presentation, there's reasons why we don't make the on-time performance, and what we have to do is analyze those and find out what it is. Sometimes it could be congested streets, accidents, incidents that take place, but we're going to do a more thorough job in taking a look at all of that. Next slide. Metro Access maintained a 91.9% on-time performance, and I must say, even with the increase in ridership of 16%, the Access service team really did a good job in maintaining their on-time performance. 65 new vehicles were received in the last couple of months. Implemented the door-to-door service, which we have a presentation that you'll see shortly. Established a web-based reservation system and published a new customer guide. Next slide. Operation services. Escalator availability exceeded its goal tonight.
Can I interrupt you just for a second on the Metro Extra? The Metro Access. I have Metro Extra on my mind. I have asked on various occasions for information on how our free smart trip cards are working in this area. I mean, this board authorized that program. And, do we have an update on all of that?
Yes,
I think everyone remembers what I'm talking about.
Good morning, Mr. Graham. I'm going to ask our Director of ADA Programs, Glenn Millis, to respond on this issue.
Good morning. I'm pleased to report that we're doing well with making our customers who use paratransit aware that they can ride on bus and rail for free. It's been well received, and growth has happened in the number of people who are doing that. In 2007, we had 78,922 rides taken on the bus by Metro Access customers, and each of those rides represents a major savings in that it wasn't taken on Metro Access. This year, through July, we're up to about 105,000 trips, and we are expanding our efforts to push those numbers even further. So we've done substantial outreach. The program's well received. We're finding that some of our Metro Access customers can use bus and rail, are taking those trips on bus and rail, and we're working hard with them to encourage those numbers. When a person comes in for Metro Access eligibility these days, we tell them that you can take free trips on bus and rail. If they don't know how to use bus and rail, we have travel trainers now that can help them do that. We'll go out there and show them how to use bus and rail. We have people going out to various agencies and support groups to serve people with disabilities, and we're spreading the word, and we're ramping up to do even more. People are also using rail, and we are working to better count those. When a Metro Access customer gets on a bus or goes to a train station, he shows them the Metro Access card, and the bus drivers count those trips by tapping certain buttons on the fare box. When they go to a station, they show the station manager their card, and the station manager lets them through a fare gate. If you have a temporary problem and some of the cards the station managers are using to count the trips are not working, we have those. They're being replaced this month, and we'll have better information on those trips later this year. I think the savings, if we can boil it down into a savings piece, just on bus alone this year, savings from Metro Access customers using Metro Bus is going to be about $7 million. So that's sort of a summary of where we're at. Now, I can answer questions if...
Well, thank you. I'm just trying to understand the actual mechanics of what we are doing here in two regards. Number one, are we giving Smart Trip cards to, or is some kind of a card being given to every customer who is eligible for Metro Access?
What they're given is a Metro Access ID card.
All right.
And they use that. They show that to the bus operator or the station manager. We are looking, Mr. Graham, at Smart Trip cards as a possible vehicle. That's something we want to explore this year.
So they would have a Metro Access ID card whether or not they were taking advantage of free three fares. That's necessary for the use of metro access.
Yes, sir.
So that's really not a very good. I mean, it's hard for us with that information to track how many people are actually taking advantage of it, except through what you've described to be a rather case-by-case notation of by the bus drivers. Nothing at all on the subway. Have we sent mailings to all of our Metro Access customers? And if so, when was the last mailing?
We notify people not only when they ask to become Metro Access eligible, but we have a regular newsletter that goes out that has that kind of information. One is about to go out in the next month or so. We also send emails to people that we have their email address. We have letters been sent in the past to people. We have their mailing address. We've done that as well. We also do outreach to agencies that serve customers with disabilities to make sure they have the information so they can share it with prospective customers. We've done seat drops, telling customers in Metro Access. We are doing what we can to tell customers that they can ride bus and rail for free. And I think the thing we're doing this year, which is different and I think is important, we've added some staff to actually help train them to use bus and rail. One of the things that we find is that Metro Access customers are reluctant to try bus and rail. They're afraid. They have a disability. They think something bad is going to happen. They don't think they can use bus and rail. What we're finding is that with support, they do use bus and rail. And I think that's a driver, along with the outreach that we're doing and pushing these numbers upward.
Well, I just want to say that I'm very much familiar. I worked with the disabled for 15 years. And I'm very familiar with the Americans with Disabilities Act and its broad range of conditions which are included. And, just to restate that a lot of people, of course, cannot really accommodate themselves with the regular bus and rail service, and we appreciate that. But there are those who can. And I was wondering if you could again check into how I remember when we put this program into place, the free ride program, we had some models. Arizona sticks in my mind. I don't know why. Tucson. But can we go back to those models and just see what they're doing and compare what we're doing? Because it still feels a little loose to me. And maybe there's more that we can do, because as the ridership on Metro Access has increased, did I hear 16%?
Yes.
That's got to be of concern to everyone, in the sense if there's reasonable steps we can take to reduce the costs, I think we should explore them.
We can do that.
Is there further on the issue of Metro Access?
Yes.
Mr. McKay?
Question. You mentioned you were exploring smart trip cards, which obviously would be better for tracking statistics, but how would you verify that the person who has the smart trip card is the Metro Access eligible rider?
Well, that's one of the issues we have to work through. We want to make sure that the cards are in the right hands and they're used for the right purpose. And there are controls that we could implement. We would have to sort through this if we were to do it to make sure that the cards were used by the people they were intended to. And in the event, things do happen, that someone did give a card to someone else, that we would know about it and be able to take quick and appropriate action in response.
That is the reason for the delay, is that issue.
Okay, thank you.
How does it work in the rail? I mean, people show the Metro Access ID card, but it doesn't scan. It doesn't.
No, sir. The station manager has a special card they use, and they scan that card and let the customer through.
Okay, so do you have statistics on how many times that's been scanned?
Before we ran into issues, biggest problem was the cards became damaged, they became lost, and we lost the ability to accurately recount. We've had to replace those cards. We're in that process now. But we were looking at 10 to 11,000 trips per month that were being taken on Metro Rail, and we have no reason to believe it's any less. It may be a little
but
more.
What cards are lost, are damaged?
These are special
master's cards.
These are special cards that are given to the station manager. They are swipe cards, smart trip cards, and their sole purpose is to allow the station manager to swipe a Metro Access customer through. And when he does that, he keeps track of that trip having occurred, and we were getting those numbers. Those cards were, they were bent, they were damaged, they were lost. We had enough of them so that were not available, so that we were not able to accurately count. So we are replacing all those cards. We're doing that this month. They've been ordered. We'll have them in hand. We'll be counting again in October.
I would like to add one additional piece to that, though. That's not the only challenge. That also, when a station manager sees a customer with a disability and they show their Metro Access ID, there are really two ways that someone could pass into the system. And one of them is when the station manager uses a smart card and opens the gate, which is what we want, because that's trackable. The other way is if the station manager opens the emergency gate, which is basically a physical metal gate, person goes through and there is not a record. We are really emphasizing to the station personnel that we don't want them to do that. Because of the tracking mechanism we're discussing. But you know, one of the things that I do have to credit my colleagues in rail is that they really go out of their way to be accommodating. They're trying to give good customer service, and they're trying to let the customer through the gate in the most accommodating manner that they can. But we've been emphasizing to them the importance that we really do want to track our paratransit customers' use of the rail system.
Okay, good. Anything further on this issue? Okay, back to you, Mr. Graham.
Thank you, Mr. Graham. Where we at? This next slide is really a capture of what we just talked about in FY08, if you want to go through it. But, let me finish on this one. On the operations services, we completed several infrastructure improvements in the area of elevator escalators, station enhancement, and the expansion of three rail yards. Okay, now next slide. And this is a performance chart for years in, 07 versus 08. Some of the information that I just shared with you earlier are listed in here. I could go down through here, or we can continue on. Okay.
Why don't you go down through here?
Okay. On-time performance, 07 versus 08, as you can see, was 92%. The last 6 months, I believe, in rail operations was somewhere close to the 93, but we're 1% is down. Our goal still stays at 95. Safety and security, crimes excluding parking, as you can see, in 07 it was 399, up in 08, and the same for the crimes in parking. Customer satisfaction.
So what kind of percentage increases are these? This looks like it's 20% increase in crimes and excluding parking, is that right?
Yes, that's what it appears to be. And that's, you know, statistically, it gives you a big number, but if you look at the total number of crimes, statistically is low. But yes, that is an increase, and mainly it's something that's been reflected around the country. People still need catalytic converters, roll covers, and radios or iPods out of automobiles.
Well, but this is excluding parking. This is excluding car break-ins.
Oh, there's crimes in parking. I'm sorry, there's two different parts.
Right. So, okay. but the first category is to take out parking. Right?
Okay. Yes. Mm-hmm.
So this would exclude break-ins of cars.
Right.
Is that yes or no?
That's correct.
First, parking crimes. Generally, crimes against the person, assaults, for instance, robberies, increase in this year.
So, but I just want to say, so crimes these are crimes against the person by and large. So we're seeing quite a spike here.
Yes.
Even though we recognize that compared to the number of people who use the system, it's a very tiny number, it surely must be a matter of concern.
Yeah, follow up on that. The question is, have you taken any action to kind of look at why that is and deploy additional people in certain areas?
Absolutely.
Is it focused into certain areas, or is it pretty much throughout the whole system?
This is a nationwide trend.
No, I'm talking about within our own metro system.
Within our own metro system, yes. What we've seen is the increase in number of thefts of iPods, for instance, handheld devices such as cell phones and what have you, because the people who are carrying those devices are usually distracted by the headsets and so forth. So people do what we call a snatch and grab. They run right up behind the person, grab the iPod or cell phone out of hand as the doors on the train is closing, and they make good their escape. That's been a trend we've been following quite closely lately. We've actually underwent a restructuring under Chief Taborn's stay here, and we've deployed additional resources in that area to address the increases in crimes against
now, this,
the person.
This number, for instance, the iPods or the cell phones, this doesn't include the ones that are lost, does it?
No.
In other words, because, you know, there was a report on the lost and found and what we're finding there, but it doesn't
right, that is not a crime against the person.
Right.
Right. Yes, sir.
Mr. Lenton?
This peaking or increase in crime is crime against the person. You're counting snatch and runs.
Yes.
How about actual assaults?
Yes, assaults are included in that number. Okay. Simple assaults and aggravated assaults.
Okay.
What could you, and you may not be able to do that here, but is there increases in those particular categories that are more of those snatch and runs, or are there significant increases on physical assaults?
The majority of the increases that we're seeing are in the robberies. Not only the snatch and grabs, but robbery pickpockets and robbery force and violence as well.
Are you getting the jurisdictional statistics in the same categories and looking at those as well?
Yes.
Okay, so when you make your reference, you're referencing not only nationally but also jurisdictional pieces.
Yes.
Because these do reflect similar jurisdictional concerns, and at least in ours, and it would be interesting
absolutely.
To see how those numbers look throughout the region.
Mr. McKay?
One other question. With the crimes in parking, are we having incidences of smash and run in parking lots too? And if that's the case, are they categorized in crimes in parking, or are they categorized in the Part 1 crimes, excluding parking?
We're not seeing many robberies, per se, in the parking areas. If the robberies occur in the bus bay, for instance, then they will be included in the station statistics and not in the parking facilities. Majority of our parking lot crimes are just those, the larcenies from autos, everything from stolen hubcaps to the GPS systems to the vehicles themselves.
Do you have, in those snatch and runs where they're taking iPods and cell phones because people are distracted, do you have a lot of purse snatchings too from people who are also maybe on the cell phone? Or
on occasion. On occasion, they do occur. However, when it comes to those types of crimes, we see more of the pickpocket crimes occurring where people actually unzip the purse, go in, take the wallet, and make good their escape, not necessarily running away with the purse itself.
But what has happened on the arrests, the number of arrests? Has that increased as well?
Yes, the amount of law enforcement activity has increased proportionally with the increase in crime. I do have a slide in my presentation to reflect the number of calls for service we're receiving, the number of arrests we're making, the number of citations.
What is the arrest increase? Since we're on this right now.
I have my statistics right here.
Yeah, just a single statistic. Also, we have authorized, have we not, Mr. Cato, the hiring of additional police officers. Do I remember 25 positions that you
yes.
recommended?
That is true. The budget does have the additional officers. We have training classes in place, and we're doing very aggressive recruiting to get those officers in place. And as mentioned, the chief has redeployed officers to the rail lines and the bus lines, as well as the parking areas. And so we have additional officers present on the platforms and on our buses.
And what's the total police force at this point?
450 authorized strength.
And how many of them are involved in administrative work?
It's about, there's about 80 personnel assigned to training, recruiting, administrative work, HR, what have you.
These are police officers that are doing HR?
No, we have a supervisor that oversees the HR. We have a number of officers assigned to things like crime analysis. We have officers assigned to the communications division.
Let's not do this right now, but for next time, will you bring us a breakdown of the police officers, people who are authorized to arrest and carry weapons and firearms and all that, who
Certainly.
Are doing administrative work, so we can see what kind of administrative work they're doing.
We're breaking down in categories of your collection.
But just give us the arrest number. I was just...
The arrests are up about 10%.
10%.
So far this year, we've made 1,026 arrests as opposed to 934 same time last year.
So you're doing a calendar year? So what year? What does year mean?
Compared from calendar year 07, January 1st to end of July to
but
this year.
You don't
year.
Have an 07, an FY 07 compared to FY 08 since FY 08 for Metro is over as of June 30th.
We will be able to get that to you for the whole year. We just did it in a 6-month period of time.
Further questions on the issue of security? We'll come back to your report.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Francis.
Hey, vertical transportation. Vertical transportation for 07 versus 08. 91-94% increase in escalator availability and elevator availability.
Did you do the bus?
Yeah, I think you skipped the bus.
I skipped the bus.
We don't want to skip bus.
I don't want to skip bus. The target for bus, as I mentioned earlier, the goal was 6,300 mean distance between failure. We finished FY08 with 6,326, so we exceeded our goal. Safety and security was 103 in crimes in FY07 and 117 in FY08. Customer satisfaction for Metro Bus satisfaction survey revealed 81%. In 07 versus 78% in 08. Vertical transportation.
Wait just a second. I think we have questions on bus. Mr. Giancola.
Yeah, if you look at the bus mean distance between failures, it looks like we've done well. But if you go back to or go forward to page 20, under performance of buses, for the last 4 months, we've had a steady decline. And obviously, the average may be looking good, but the direction is looking very bad. And I guess the question is it continued in July and August? And what was the reason for that deterioration over a period of actually five out of the 6 months?
Yeah, we have a couple of anomalies that happened here. One is that we've had a hotter than usual May, June, July.
You said hotter than usual?
Hotter, yes.
God, it seems to me it's been cooler. Mm-hmm.
That's yeah, hotter and wetter.
If you look at last year, at the beginning, well, in July, you had the same type of decline. Whenever you're in the summer with your air conditioning systems, you have additional failures. And that's where you have the drop. And then you peak up during the fall, winter, and spring months. And that's the bell curve that we've been experiencing every year. There is, we fall below the target in the summer months, we exceed the targets in the falls, winter and spring, and it averages out to the target.
Right, and then we also have another thing going on is that our fleet age is at 8.4 years. Typically we want to keep it at 7.5, and as you know, we will be receiving a lot of new buses this year, which should also help improve that.
Do you have the July and August numbers?
No.
No.
It didn't continue to go down, did it?
I don't have the July or August figures, but
July was 5,009, which is our average for the last 5 years. And we're back up 6,047.
All right, so it went back up.
Yes.
All right, okay.
We also add, we do have 321 buses of our 1,500 buses in the fleet that are 14 years or older. They operate about 14% of our total miles, but they're costing us about 27% of our service rate.
And so you're saying they're breaking down more?
The older fleet, all 14 years, are breaking down more frequently. All of our newer vehicles are within the 15-year age, are performing very nicely. That's not just within our service, that's compared to other properties.
Mr. Linton?
Is there any variation in the mean distance between failures by
vehicle type, fuel, or the like, and is that variation happening during those summer months as well?
Okay, if you look at the on that same page, page 21, and you'll see the averages there.
Okay.
It's not necessarily because of the, some of the reasons may be because of the seasons, but also particular issues with any one particular fleet.
Don't you want to be on page, some other page?
The bottom chart on page 21.
Page 20, there's a lower chart.
I'm sorry, page, my mistake, page 20.
It looks like the hybrids are not, seem to be having more of a problem than the others.
20, we should be on page 20.
20, yeah.
In fact, we did bring to the board some issues with the hybrid a few months ago.
Right.
Of systems that we had to replace.
Right.
Okay. More on bus on this point? Okay.
Okay, last was Metro Access, which I spoke spoke about earlier.
No, you haven't done the elevators and the escalators. You started to do that, and then we went back to bus, and now you want to. You're anxious to get through with this page.
No, he's trying to get by this point.
I'm just.
It makes me very suspicious.
What's he hiding?
Okay. All right. Vertical transportation. Escalators in FY07 were 91% compared to 94% in FY08. Availability in elevators was 95 in 07, and we're up in 08 at 96.7%. Metro Access on-time performance was FY07 was.
Wait a second, you got your customer satisfaction.
Oh, I'm sorry, customer
satisfaction. You got some of the lowest numbers right here.
But the customer satisfaction survey for elevators was 63% in 07, but it was up to 68% in 08. 74% in elevators is 74%.
Right. But in contrast to 85% customer satisfaction on Metro Rail.
This is true, and this is an area that...
still a problem.
It is a problem, and it's one that customers like to express to you very directly, particularly if you're at a station at a time an escalator isn't working. I get very strong comments in the negatives about this, because people have to walk up and down. And I'm not sure what the national average is on this, but it's an issue. It's a real issue for us. It's an issue around the country on escalators.
Well,
yes.
You know, we have some inherent problems. One is we have more escalators than anybody else, and you know, I don't know if, and I don't know if we're, you know, I hate to be pessimistic, but I don't know if this is an issue that we're gonna ever overcome because the design elements of our stations and the significant amount of escalators that we have, which is more prevalent than any place else in the country.
You're right, we're the highest number in the country. We have 588 escalators in our system. It's huge. Probably 589 since we did the open up the Navy Yard second entry. And that is the highest number in the country.
I think our better use of signs, though, is really helping.
It is helping when we do repairs, but I happen to be at a station where an escalator, because of the emergency switch, shut down, and the customers expressed to me, regardless of the signs, their displeasure with that. Mm-hmm. And so it is something that we work on. We will continue to, but I agree, Director Clinton, that it is going to be an area we're going to receive many complaints over the years due to.
Well, we'll keep working.
Mr.
Giancola.
One last question. If you look at all the targets in the various areas, obviously we have to do some work in the rail and bus, but in the area of metro access, in the area customer satisfaction, or not Metro, customer satisfaction, the area of elevator availability or escalator availability. Does the performance in this year, or 08, now become the new target next year, or do we go back or maintain that same target? In other words, do we want to really get any less than what we've already achieved in 08? And how are you approaching that?
Well, we did set a target of 93%, and the reason for that is we have a large number of rehabs that are scheduled for the year, and we want to be realistic in what we think we can achieve. I mean, we could set numbers that are very high, but we know based upon our experience and what's scheduled for the year, that's not going to occur. And so we're trying to be realistic here.
So these targets may change or may not change?
Yes, depending upon what the performance is like through the year.
Okay, are we done with that page?
Yes.
Yes. All right.
So Mr. Graham, now most of the appendix are backup information, but there's a couple of pages that I think you requested in the last meeting. If you want to take a look at those, you can turn to peak period door malfunctions.
Which page is that?
That is on page 18, I believe.
Page 18.
There it is.
He wanted to know the number of door malfunctions that we have each month, number of offloads versus non-offloads. So as you can see in the month from January to May, you can see the number, and this is the hard numbers, the number of door problems that we have. The ones that resulted in us able to clear and still continue on with the train movement versus the ones where we couldn't, then we had to offload the customers.
So this is just the car, of course. You're offloading just the car.
Yes.
You're not offloading.
Well, no, it would involve the whole train, the entire train.
So these incidents with the horizontal bars are where you offloaded the entire train.
No, it is for May, for example, there was 97 incidents, total door malfunctions.
No, the horizontal bars, the 20. Is this a complete train offload?
Yes.
So it's not possible just to offload a car and move people to another car. You have to empty the entire train in these situations.
Normally during the peak rush service, because the headways are so tight, because we're running anywhere from 2 to 2.5 minute headways, we end up offloading the train, because the train is pretty much right behind. Because on a 6 or 8 car train, depending on what door is the problem, it's hard for the operator to get back. By the time he or she gets back to a certain door, we might have lost that time.
Let me explain. If the doors malfunction, the operator's not sure which car it is, the time it takes the operator to go back and to check the issue, to shut down the one car, exceeds the time between the headways of the car following that one. So we have learned operationally it is more timely and has the least impact to the system if we offload the car, get the car out of the way, let the next car come up and pick up the customer.
Next train. Okay.
Thank you.
And how many, you have here the average of 219,000 door openings per day, but perhaps more relevant would be the number of trains per day, because you're offloading 20 of them. What is the total number of trains during the peak period that could be affected by?
Well, during the peak rush hour, we operate 131 trains.
131 trains.
And 830,
It's a number higher than that. I know where you're going with this.
Okay, go ahead.
It's a total number of trains.
I was going to say we average over 13,500 train stops a day throughout the system, as we're servicing platforms.
These are 20 trains, if I follow your answers. These are 20 trains that you've taken out of service.
Yes, out of the 13,500.
No, during the peak period. This is during the peak period.
Okay, yes.
So it's not, so what are the numbers that we should, what are the apples and the apples here?
Well, the apples and the apples, it's not, you can't just take the 128 trains, because this 20 occurs in, you know, trips back and forth,
and
when you count the number
period
of trains back and forth, is the number is.
Yeah. I think what we would have to do is go back and relook at our numbers and then say, okay, out of these 13,500 trips that we have a day, that value X is represents what we do during the peak, and value X would be what we do off peak.
Well, you understand what I'm trying to get a sense of how how serious this problem is.
It's,
I mean, we're taking 20 trains out of service. That's less than one a day in the month of, well, it's almost one a day in the month of March. Ms. Hutchins?
I was wondering if you could remind me, when you look at the malfunction for the doors, are you able to distinguish whether it is within the car, train, the car itself, or with the, any interference with the door?
We really do not have any clear diagnostics on our fleets. It's pretty much we just have one indication light on the outside of each individual car, and then the operators have to go back and assess each respective door on that respective car. So if we're in an 8-car train and they have maybe a possible indication, they might have to walk all the way to the end of the platform, look at that specific piece of equipment, and then they would have to go through that entire rail car. So that's why by the time you send somebody all the way down, try to do that assessment, we're in the middle of peak at 2 or 2.5 minute headways, it's sometimes a little bit faster for them to go ahead and request an offload at that time to keep the rest of the system moving throughout.
I'm understanding the offloading challenge you have, but in that assessment of determining the problem, are you able to make the analysis of whether or not?
Sometimes you are, sometimes you are not.
There's no consistent way.
Yeah, and also, for example, they might not, they might try it at one station, and we might take a delay at the at one station. They might think that they have it resolved, they'll go to another station. If they had another incident or problem in that area, it's time for us to, you know, they would make the call to go ahead and get the train out of service.
If I understand your question, you're really asking the causes of it?
Yeah, we look at these numbers each time, and we recognize that malfunctioning doors, I won't say cause a great deal, But once it causes a problem, it has a great impact on the system.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, we've talked about how we can help, one, the customer understand the role that they play in that, and I think for our benefit, how we distinguish the quality of the car and its functionality versus the human intervention aspect there. And I'm just wondering, are we getting anywhere in trying to do that? Because there is a level of what we probably cannot impact with improvement.
The answer is on the, some of the issues, particularly the human aspect, as much as we communicate, we still have the same issue of people holding the doors and result jamming the doors and have to offload those cars. We've not had much success in trying to change their behaviors. From the mechanical standpoint, have worked on some issues to reduce doors that jam.
Well, what is your appraisal of this? I mean, you know, taking 26 trains out of service during the peak period and during the month of March, how serious was that?
Well, anytime you take a train out of service, to me, is serious. But given the number of trains that we operate, and we need to do the statistics on this, as you said, it averages once a day, and there are two peaks. And when you do those numbers, it's far below 0.5% of the cars that have a malfunction because of doors. Now, again, any malfunction I'm not happy with, but when you operate 99.5% without a malfunction because of doors, that's significant achievement. You'll never get to 100%. I wish you could, but you won't. Even if every car was brand new, you're going to have something that happens.
And tell me just one last question. How many trains are we operating during the peak period?
The total number of trains is 100.
Rail cars total?
No.
Trains. 128.
Yes.
128. So it's, in effect, it's 1/128.
Yes.
Of our capacity.
Actually, you have to double the 128 because remember you have two peaks.
Right, during one peak period, I'm just saying two peak period. Yes. So it's one. Okay. Right, further on this, all right. We had asked for all this the last time.
Yes, you did.
Why I wanted to. Okay.
And the last slide, Mr. Graham, is the escalator and elevators, if you want to, April's top 12.
Well, here, can you spotlight for us, because we've discussed this before the meeting, we discussed this last week. What are the repeaters here? I didn't get a chance to do that analysis,
okay.
but what are the repeaters over a three-month period?
All right, you can't see it on the screen. We highlighted the repeaters in yellow, but you can't see it on the screen.
Oh, I can see it on the screen. I can't see it on my material. So Anacostia is a repeater. Vienna is a repeater. Is there a two-month repeater or a one-month?
Yeah, you have Anacostia for April, Anacostia Vienna for April, and you also have it for May.
Same unit.
Yeah.
Same unit. That's
same
important
unit.
To know. And Vienna, the same unit for 2 months?
For 2 months, yes, April and May.
And McPherson Square, the same unit for how many months?
McPherson Square is the same unit for... April and June, looks like.
Okay. 2 months.
2 months.
All right. So let's ask a question about that. Well, what is your analysis of these units that are failing repeatedly?
I'm going to ask the escalator coming to address that issue. He's been working on it.
Well, for each unit, there's different reasons. At Anacostia, there's the majority of the outages are related to the comb impact switches. We did have one accident in April that had the unit out of service for 45 hours. For McPherson Square, it looks like we have safety switch trips, which brought this up there for April and June. And for Vienna, again, it was safety switches being tripped for both of those months.
I think one of the things that's apparent to me is a result of how we've been analyzing this. If we could find a more expeditious way of resetting the safety switches, we would address a huge part of this problem. I mean, with all the technological advances available to us in the United States of America and the world, I mean, are we exploring ways in which we can reset these safety switches more rapidly? In other words, could we train the station manager? Or, I mean, can something be done here to avoid these hours of just simply getting to the issue? What is involved in resetting a safety?
Well, it depends. Station managers take their key and the escalator would start, and other times it would not because it required an inspection and some type of a mechanic to come out, open up the panels, and reset it that way. Some restarts will start with the key. Some will not.
There are two types of safety switches in the escalators. One of them can be reset by the station manager simply by restarting it with the key. The other type is called a manual reset switch, and the elevator and escalator codes mandate that when those switches are tripped, someone has to come out and visually inspect the unit to reset it. And that's why those switches are those type, because it literally requires that someone go to that switch to reset it.
Okay, how many of these, I don't expect you to have this answer, but you might. You know, how many of these safety switch resets could have been done by the general manager, but weren't the station manager?
Thank you for that new assignment.
In your copious free time.
Yeah.
By the station manager, but weren't.
The
in other words, how often is this? I mean, are there times when the station manager ought to be doing this and they're not doing it, and it's leading to further delays? I mean, I mean, this looks like it could be a possible easy fix for some of these. Is it or is it not?
I will. The numbers that I have here make me assume that these are all manual resets, because if the station manager could reset it with the key, they wouldn't open a ticket and we wouldn't see it. Now, what I can do, I don't think the number is going to change. You know, I don't think I'll find a lot, but I can start looking to see if we were called out to reset a switch that the station manager could have reset.
Okay. Can you have a quick look at that?
Yes.
You don't have to do a master's thesis on this subject, but if you could have a quick look at it just to see if there's some easy fixes there. Because this is our problem, resetting the safety switches in significant part.
Just a trivia. So the operating procedures we're not clear on that says when I get a ticket, it's not the first question you ask, did you turn the computer on? I mean, the equivalent. because I thought I was understanding the process and Mr. Graham's question going there.
Oh.
Your lack of certainty kind of concerns me then when you said you don't know when you get a ticket whether you know the station manager has said, yes, I tried the key, and now I'm going to open a ticket.
That is the way it is designed to work.
Okay, because I probably...
What I'm not certain with is if that's actually working the way it's designed to work.
Okay, I'll
he's
take going that.
To check on it.
Yes. Well, I guess yes, but then who's going to tell
I mean, it would be,
I
think Ms. Hutchins makes a very good point, because it would be relatively straightforward for us to have on this ticket. You called it a ticket, didn't you?
Yes.
A box that said, I tried to fix this and it didn't work. Check. You know, I mean, something of this, some way of us being assured that the station manager actually tried to do something.
We can do that. I have a high comfort level. It takes the station manager more effort to do the ticket than to go sit the key in the escalator and turn it.
But they might have made like writing tickets. You don't know. You don't know.
Yeah, along the same lines, on page 24 or 58 on the top, Crystal City number 6. And this is a good question, I think, to raise. You know, if in fact the station manager can in fact reset, is that person doing it? And maybe the procedures are not clear. 28 resets of safety switches. Although one replaced comb finger section, one safety. So it appears to me that of the 28, there were only 3 specific actions that some of the maintenance people took. You know, and so that implies to me that maybe 25 of those could have been an easy reset. I mean, I'm just looking at it as an example. Because 28 resets in 1 month, it seems to me an awful lot.
Aren't there resets that it does not require any replacements or adjustments? But it does require an inspector to come out to look. You can't, and we will do the analysis, but it doesn't necessarily follow that there were 28 resets and only 3 of them required work, that the other 25 could have been started with the key.
But one of them said a safety inspection. That implies that somebody did look at for one of those.
No, I think maybe our terminology here is wrong. Let us do the analysis and bring that back.
Because there's 2 resets, one with the key and one opening it up.
Yes.
And both are called resets.
Yes.
And so let's look at it. You never know. You know. And okay, is there more on that? Okay. Back to you, Mr. Francis. We're giving you a lot of time to think about things.
That's the end of the operations.
You don't want to say anything about elevators?
Oh.
He doesn't want to get
okay. He's not hiding anything again either.
No. Are there repeaters in the elevators?
It looks like
well, look at all these yellow. Look at all this yellow on June. These are all repeaters in June. Look at all the okay, let it go. We'll come back to the repeaters next month. The elevators, we've got repeaters Ballston, Capitol Heights, Roslyn. Are each of those 2-month repeaters, same unit?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. So See, this is important for those of you who may be new to this process, you know, because we're not just satisfying ourselves with a 93% performance. We're digging down deeper into these numbers to see if we've got repeat problems.
And some of these are repeat. Not only are they repeaters, but they're repeaters in several consecutive months.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. That's
the
point.
You have them in April, May, and June.
That's exactly the point.
So several times within the month, and then in consecutive months on top of that.
But, and it's also interesting, the resets with elevators is a lot lower, obviously, than the escalators. So there are other problems with the elevators. Well, do you want to say something about the repeat problems in the elevator world?
Well, I can say something overall about the problems, the problems. I'm going to give a little cheat card here again. The 200 and I think it's 45 now elevators that we have in the system. Some of those are fairly old, and we go through and we rehab those. But it's like anything that's electronic. There are things that happen, and we go back to repair those. They're used 20 hours a day, 7 days a week. And I think statistically, again, and we need to do, I mean, again, I'd like to have 100%, but we don't.
But what are you concerned about the entrapment issue here?
Oh, I'm always concerned about entrapment, yes.
How many hours were these people entrapped? And you got two entrapments, not one, but two at Capitol Heights.
Yep.
One at, how many other, what's your total entrapments for elevators?
You have three entrapments at Capitol Heights
and then entrapments don't, first, let me clarify something. Entrapments, you're stuck in an elevator for minutes. You know, most entrapments are you're rescued within a half an hour. Some may go a little longer. The issue that shows up there is the elevator stays out of service after an entrapment, so we can fully investigate why.
Okay, that's very reassuring. In other words, the entrapment itself is not 47
hours. Yeah.
Well, you never know what people will, you know, conclude. You know.
That would be on the nightly news.
Yeah. Okay, good. All right. The next time, Mr. Francis, we won't put you into the hot spot here in terms of incident analysis. But the next time, look at the, have you and your staff look at the repeat situation, the repeaters, so that we can have just a little bit of analysis, summary analysis of the repeated problem, the repeaters, okay?
Okay.
In both areas, would you do that? Mr. Linton?
Mr. Chairman, one question I have is, have we've done any analysis of the design issues or frequency of use, demand on, demand at various stations, and I mean that's contributing to failures? I mean, is it, for instance, would a particular design at a station lend itself to more elevator usage? You know, is that tracking more failure because of wear and tear? I'm trying to see if there's anything there that we've examined that would suggest stations with higher demand, more frequency of use, the structure of the escalators versus elevators would lend itself to more failures.
I'm going to let the escalator people speak, but this, my observation has been, we have a station like Gallery Place.
Right.
Have events at night where you have thousands of people coming at the same time. You have failures because of overloads of people jumping up and down on the escalator itself. I can't say that explains some of the others like Capitol Heights, but so that's just the elevators.
I mean, that's
But the escalators, those are the type of, those places we do have more because of the large crowds that come in a very short period of time.
Yeah, I'm trying to find out if there's any correlation between volume, usage, activity, and failures.
Right. But then it would follow that Metro Center would have the worst problem.
Yeah.
Or Gallery Place. Unless there was some other.
Okay.
Right.
You know, we're going to keep doing these statistics, but as you mentioned before, Director, when you have this many elevators and escalators and the number of people using it, the weather, with the age and all the factors.
Yeah.
It's going to be a discussion we're going to have.
Continue.
And you could double the amount of monies that you put into the repairs, and guess what? You're going to have a problem with escalators and elevators. It's not unique here.
I agree.
But it is something that we're obviously focused on, and obviously you are too. And so it's in our interest, from a customer service standpoint, to have them working. It's also in my interest that we have them working, so you don't assign me the duties of going out and turning them on with my key.
I'm just wondering if, you know, we have these design issues, and I'm wondering if there's some other things we can do. Because I just think that the magnitude of this problem will continue because of the nature of our system. And if there's other things that we can deal with.
Okay. And Mr. McKay.
Yeah, one question on page 22, not to go back to escalators, but I do have one observation and question. The Huntington station on page 22 seems to be out a lot of hours, but when I look at the comments, it doesn't seem, I don't get the feeling that a lot's going on. 10 reset of safety switches, but can you describe for me what is going on at that station that's causing it to be out of service that much with only 10 safety switch resets, and I don't know what a reverse phase relay and an adjusted speed sensor is, but it seems like it's out for an awful lot of time with not a lot going on.
Yeah, other than what's there right now, I mean, I could look into the specific times of the outages. That's what I think happened. It took a long time. Maybe we were waiting for a part or something that caused it to be out for a long time, because relatively speaking, that you're right, that's not a lot of outages compared to the amount of time it was out. So my guess right now, and it's only a guess, is we were probably waiting for a part.
And is that, do you know if that number one escalator, is that the outdoor one or the one undercover? Because it goes to the question you were asking about station design too. Because
that one, I believe, is south one, which is the outside one that goes up the little hill.
Right, and I guess in looking at that particular station, can we look at if the weather is a contributor to that? Because I've noticed, you know, in a lot of stations we make a lot of headway putting overheads or canopies over top of the escalators, and this is not one of them.
Right, and that one I can honestly answer, weather is definitely a contributing factor. Every time it rains, we have issues that are caused by water.
Okay, so I guess that lends to the next natural question, which is where is this station on a list of having a canopy installed given the statistics on this page?
We are bringing forth the CID program the next month and over the next month, and that will identify the needs that we have for canopies and stations that are exposed to the elements.
Okay, thank you.
And that leads to a very interesting question in my mind, which is, have the canopies worked, and what evidence do we have on that subject at this point? Because
they're very expensive,
and for those of us who went through that whole process A to Z. Actually, we went several times down the alphabet on that process. I would be very interested in knowing what our appraisal is of to what extent have the canopies contributed here. How many stations do we have left that don't have canopies?
I don't know.
You got the day?
Off the top of my head, I'm going to say about a half a dozen. The national parks, Smithsonian.
So we've essentially done the canopies.
Yes.
Right? So do we have any? You don't agree with that, Mr.
I think we need to look. I think it's might be some number larger than that.
Okay. Well, but is it time for us to begin to assemble some analysis?
Yes.
On to what extent have these canopies contributed?
Have helped. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Helped. Yeah. Contributed to resolving the problem.
I got you.
To finish the sentence.
Yeah. We will do that. But
can we do that?
Yes.
Can we have it for next time?
Yes, we can.
All right, that's good. That'll be very interesting. And what was the total cost of the canopy project again? Does anybody remember? $300 million, I think, or something like that?
Everyone is shaking their head. They don't know at the top of their head. It was a very large number.
I think it was around $300 million. But anyway,
incredibly large.
So we should certainly have a look and see what we did with that. Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Piquet. Is that it?
Mm-hmm.
Is that all we have?
Yes.
Okay. Now, are we finished with your report, Mr. Francis?
Yes, we are.
We're
I just want to make sure. Check
well, you don't area. Have to be finished.
No, no. We're finished.
I have to be finished.
Yeah.
I think this is time well spent. I mean, we usually are rushing for them, but the next agenda is relatively light, as I remember. So we're not. What's next, Mr. Cato? Do we do? We go back to the police, or what are we doing?
Yes. Yes. We do the state.
Chief Claiborne is out of town attending the APTA conference in Atlanta, so I'm sitting in for him. My name is Jeff Delinsky, Deputy Chief of the Patrol Operations Bureau. And I'm going to present the Metro Transit Police crime statistics and event information. The first slide is a depiction of, from calendar year 2003 to currently 2008, of the Part 1 crime. Those are the most serious offenses that are listed here as reported to the FBI. And as you can see, aggravated assaults are 55, two burglaries so far this year, 456 larcenies, 145 attempt motor vehicle thefts and motor vehicle thefts, 328 robberies for a total of 986 Part 1 offenses so far. The next slide shows the correlation between the number of vehicles parked on a weekday versus the amount of crime experienced in that parking lot. For instance, you see Addison Road, there's one parking lot crime committed there for every 4,639 parked vehicles. The next slide shows the reported crime to the Metro Transit Police on a yearly basis, which is about 13,000 reports compared to the local service area that we do serve, and you can this chart depicts that Metro is still one of the safest places to be in the region. The next slide shows the District of Columbia top 10 stations ranked by Part 1 crime, with Gallery Place leading the way with 25 Part 1 crimes, down to Columbia Heights with 11.
Now let's remind ourselves, Part 1 crime, that was your first graph, is that right?
Yes, sir. Those include
Part 1 crime, yeah.
The aggravated assaults, burglaries, homicides, larcenies, motor vehicle theft.
What's crime. Part 2 crime?
Those are lesser offenses such as petty theft, some of the public conduct ordinance violations, disorderly conduct, destruction of property.
Is it distinguished by seriousness?
Basically,
the gravity,
yes.
Of the crime or the offense or the penalty?
Federal Bureau of Investigation sets the standards on what's Part 1 crime and what's Part 2.
But anyway, Part 1 is the more serious.
Yes. Okay, this slide shows the top 10 stations for the Commonwealth of Virginia ranked by Part 1 crime. Vienna with 36 Part 1 offenses so far this year, down to Pentagon City with 3. Next slide is the top 10 Maryland Metro Rail stations ranked by Part 1 crime, with New Carrollton 44, down to Silver Spring with 19. This slide here shows that the Metro Transit Police are very active this year. We're doing a lot of hard work trying to curb the increases we're seeing in crime. We received over 34,000 calls for service so far this year. Over 1,000 arrests were made, 3,700 criminal and civil citations were written, and over 1,700 fare evasion citations. And, again, I can't emphasize enough that the Metrorail system is still one of the safest places to be. The probability of being a victim of a Part 1 crime is 2.48 per million riders, which is extremely low.
Mayor Yule?
Yes, thank you. The received 34,876 calls for service. Is that a combination of calls actually made? I mean, people calling in and or your officers actually just normal patrol responding, acting and responding.
Those are the phone calls that we receive.
Just phone calls.
Through our communications division. That does not reflect our self-initiated activity, such as a stop or a contact or someone who is jumping the fare gauge or something like that.
Is there a comparison, perhaps, over the last 5-10 years that we can get?
There is, but the numbers are a little bit skewed because this year we upgraded to a computer-aided dispatch system, and we set different standards. We wanted to be as accurate as possible, so we took out, for instance, self-initiated activity. So charts will actually show a decrease in calls for service as a result of this new computer-aided dispatch.
And like I ask Sal Police Department all the time, you know, you make the arrests, got to go to court. How much time is spent in court, and what's the cost?
I can give you that number.
Okay.
I'll look at that.
Will you bring that to us the next time?
I will.
Because I think a lot of people would like to know the answer to that question.
I will. Okay. And then the significant events. As you know, today at the Pentagon, the big memorial dedication, Montgomery County Police Department does their 9/11 transportation security detail, where they have officers in plain clothes and uniform around in and around the Metrorail stations in Montgomery County. And then, of course, our police department for this week has uniform and plain clothes details throughout the entire system, looking for any suspicious activity. And as a show of force. A lot of other significant events coming up in the next 6 months. The Army 10-miler on October 5th, 26,000 people expected to run in that race. Marine Corps Marathon on October 26th, 30,000 people expected to participate there. And, of course, the anticipated presidential election on November 4th, followed by the inauguration in January and the March for Life rally January 21st.
How are we coming on the hiring of the 25 new officers?
It's slow, to be quite honest with you, because we have traditionally emphasized quality, not quantity. So, and you know, a number of the agencies in this area are competing from the same pools that we are. We've reached out to online, such as monsterjobs.com and CareerBuilder, looking for applicants outside this region. Our recruiters are going up to New York and down to the Carolinas, recruiting at colleges and universities and so forth. It's a slow process, but we are making some headway. We're getting good quality recruits.
What percentage of the police force is bilingual in Spanish?
There are a handful of officers who are bilingual. I can give you the exact number at a later date, but it's around 10.
10 out of 200?
At about 400.
Of 400. So maybe there's an opportunity here to hire more Spanish-speaking officers.
Absolutely.
Can we consider that as part of our priority in this hire?
Absolutely.
Are you capable of having lateral hires, too? I suppose you can, aren't you?
Yes, we do. We reach out to the other agencies and offer them a lateral entry program where they can come in here at an elevated salary. If they have, we can grant them up to 5 years of service.
Right. Have you ever considered lateral hires from Puerto Rico?
I think we looked at that at the same time that Metropolitan Police went to Puerto Rico, and the feedback that we received that it wasn't a complete success, that a number of people that were recruited actually became homesick or something along those lines and went back to Puerto Rico after a short amount of time.
But it did produce, I think they hired 60 officers from Puerto Rico, and it did produce a success rate of about 50%. Mm-hmm. And in that way, we were able to significantly increase our Spanish-speaking abilities. And so, you know, even if you picked up 5 officers, you'd improve that number by 50%.
Certainly.
And I think that going that type of route, you know, might you know, depending on what standards are set, might make a lot of sense.
Check into that.
It doesn't seem like we're doing a very good job in terms of Spanish speaking.
I would agree with you, and we have an outreach program to improve in that area, but we've not had a great deal of success. Nowhere near the population availability. So that is an area that I have expressed concern on, and working very hard. Again, we would do whatever it takes to prove that, and we will look into the Puerto Rico recruitment efforts the Metropolitan Police Department.
Right. Miami is another place, which we've had some success with. But can we have the assurance that this is going to be a priority in this new line?
It is a priority, and you do have my assurance on that.
Okay. Anything more for the police? Okay, thank you very much, Deputy Chief.
Excellent, so, yes.
Is that it?
No, we still have access services.
Yes, of course we do. Yes.
Home site safety. Then we get the access services.
Good morning. My name is Ron Edwards. I'm the manager of rail safety. I'm sitting in for Ron Keel, who's also at the
safety conference in Atlanta.
Atlanta, correct. I'll be presenting the safety performance indicator report. What we did was we isolated the month of June. In this first slide, we have shown the rail passenger injuries. We have for the month of June of 14, which is a little bit slightly higher than we had last year the same time, which we had 12. Rail passenger facility occupant injuries, we are down 3 from 18 to 15. The passenger injury rate is slightly elevated for the month of June from the previous year, as well as the, if you also see the escalator injuries are down from 19 to 13. Rail collisions are 0. Mainline derailments, we have one mainline derailment that took place June 9th of this year. That derailment is still on investigation at this time. Fire incidents were slightly up for the month of June, as well as smoke incidents were down 6 for the month of June. The next slide shows a comparison of those same data, that same data set, FY07 through FY08, close out the entire fiscal year. You can see the variances to the far right. Of course, rail passenger injuries are down 79. Rail transit facility occupant injuries are down 123. And our escalator injuries are also down 157.
That's a very good report.
Thank you. The next slide is for bus. Our bus passenger injuries for the month of June, we are down 10, which is a significant number of significant decrease, if you will. Preventable bus collisions are also slightly down. Non-preventables are also down from 4.83 to 2.14, as well as our bus passenger injury rate is also down from 0.36 to 0.09.
Right.
Next slide is also a comparison from FY07 to FY08, also showing the variances to the far right. Bus passenger injuries are down 87. Preventable collisions are down to 1.93 as far as the rate, as well as the non-preventables is slightly down from 3.49 to 3.38. And our bus passenger injury rate is also down to 0.84. And that concludes the presentation. If there are any questions?
I just have one question. The numbers are looking good, you know, in terms of what we're hearing. What about the gravity of these injuries? We don't have information on that aspect. You could have one of these that was, very, very serious, which would offset, the otherwise very positive report. I mean, what can you say about the comparative gravity of the injury?
Well, the data that we have here presents anywhere from a finger getting caught in the escalator or a bus patron falling on the bus to something severe where a bus operator made an urgent stop and several patrons may have got hurt on that one specific bus. That severity is not broken down in this report, but I'm sure that's something that we can pull out.
Well, let's have, if I may, rather than going into it now, let's have that additional dimension at our next meeting. Or is if you go back and give us a sense of, and I leave the definitions to your good judgment as to what is serious, but there must be a way of determining that we can have a look at that. Is that possible? Okay, good. Mr. Linton?
I just want to underscore the significant reductions in incidents and the outstanding safety performance that has occurred. I think it's important that we draw attention to it when it's good, because so much attention gets drawn to it when we have the pendulum moving in the other direction.
That's right.
So I think that obviously there's some results of some of the safety work that has been done that Mr. Cato was brought on, and we're glad to see those numbers moving in that direction. I'd just like to commend all your staff for the work in getting that done.
Thank you.
That's good. Thank you very much, Mr. Linton. Ms.
Yeah, if I could follow up on Mr. Linton, I just wanted to, I too wanted to say that's really good news, and wanted to emphasize that we're glad that everyone is hearing our concerns, and we're making drastic improvements there. And I was hoping that that was the reason in terms of our training and the edicts that we've set down about safety. And that your that would be your explanation
that would, exactly.
of why the things are why the preventable accidents
absolutely.
Are down.
Absolutely.
Okay. And even the non-preventable is that it's down ever so slightly. I mean, not the non-preventable.
The non-preventable is down very slightly. But we are.
Is that defensive?
Those are defensive tactics that probably were made by the bus operator themselves. But preventables are. I mean, non-preventables are made when the bus. Runs into the vehicles. Like we had an incident yesterday where we had a bus ran into a vehicle, run a stop sign, and ran directly into a bus. So those are non-preventable. The bus operator did everything they were supposed to do, but yet they could not avoid the accident.
Okay. But I mean, maybe through the additional training, we're learning. They're learning more.
Yes.
Operational and defensive maneuvers.
We still have a long way to go, but okay. We have come a long way from last year.
We noticed that there were. Seem to be a lack of reporters at the time.
Yeah, they all left.
So, somehow safety doesn't sell, but.
So we'll repeat all this. Yeah, you did your own press release.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And thank now you. We'll proceed to Metro Access, our report on Metro Access.
I'm excited to share with you today an information item on the implementation of Metro Access door-to-door service. As you know, we transitioned from curb-to-curb service model to door-to-door on June 30th, 2008. And I want to share with you some of the details that led up to that implementation and what we've experienced so far. Door-to-door implementation involved a number of major policy changes that were enacted. And these included, of course, most obviously, the driver now escorts the customer from the outermost door to the vehicle, and then from the vehicle to the outermost door of their destination. The vehicle wait time has also been reduced from 10 minutes to 5 minutes. And customers are now aware of and expecting 100% customer ID checks to ensure that the correct customer is meeting the correct driver, getting on the correct vehicle, and going to the proper destination, which we felt was very important, and actually brings some a higher level of comfort for the customers, for the drivers, and some efficiency to the process of communicating that information. Additionally, we have improved customer service with door-to-door on the next slide. There's safety assistance now on that entire path of travel between the door and the vehicle. Customers have been reporting to us that they greatly appreciate that additional assistance and the comfort level that they have, even if they don't require additional assistance, that there's somebody there just in case. There's a faster boarding process for customers as well. And there's a more reliable connection between drivers and customers at public places where crowds and other things might make it more difficult for a customer to find their Metro Access vehicle or vice versa. So that's also been wonderful. On the next slide, with safety as our primary concern, obviously, in implementing door-to-door service, we had to create certain logistical parameters in which the drivers would function when providing this service. The door must always be within direct line of sight of the vehicle, and the vehicle must always be within 150 feet of that door that's being serviced for door-to-door service. There must always be a safe path of travel for both the driver and that customer to travel between doors. And the vehicle must always be parked in a safe location that doesn't impede traffic in any way or require the driver to make any unsafe maneuvers when getting into or out of that parking space. On the next slide, okay, great. we've highlighted the public process that we went through leading up to the launch of door-to-door. And as you know, and as we've had the opportunity to share in the past, we've kept the community very engaged with this process. There were three public information sessions, one in Maryland, one in the district, and one in Virginia, letting customers come, learn about door-to-door service, ask questions prior to the launch so that they would be prepared for the changes. And there was a four-month information campaign during which we addressed over a dozen different disability organizations and customer groups throughout the jurisdictions, including all of the jurisdictional commissions on disability. And there was also a great deal of customer input starting last summer, in fact, on the creation of the door-to-door policy and how we would pass that information on to our customers and train our drivers on those changes. There have been numerous reference and informational publications that have been put out in accessible format for all of our customers leading up to the change, because no matter how many meetings we have, we want to make sure that we're reaching out to as many people as possible and providing them reference material in case they have questions after the fact. We did an instructional video that shows customers how to use the door-to-door process most effectively, and also was used during our driver training so that they could get a nice view in the training room of how this should work with customers. We revised our customer guide to include the door-to-door policy and the 100% ID check policy that I referenced earlier. We produced a short fact sheet on door-to-door, just specifically honing in on door-to-door procedures. And all of these publications were mailed directly to customers in the 3 months preceding the launch of door-to-door. And we purposely staggered the mailing so that if somebody somehow overlooked one mailing, they were going to get another. We hoped that all of that information was really getting out to people. And then we also put it all on the website, including a spoken word format of the customer guide for customers for whom listening to the guide would be more accessible than reading it in any way. Our initial findings with door-to-door, now that we've been doing it for a few months, are that we have definitely received positive customer feedback. We've seen some reduction in the vehicle dwell time. And we're also recognizing that there is absolutely a need for continued driver training, proper procedures for door-to-door service. Our next steps at this point is that we are going to be conducting a comprehensive review of door-to-door at the six-month mark from implementation. And that timeline gives us the opportunity to make sure that we've collected appropriate data to do an effective analysis, and also give our employees a chance for greater proficiency at providing door-to-door so that we can better analyze where they are at that point. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Other questions on Metro Access? Thank you for that very positive report. Do you have a question, Mr.
Chairman? There is another issue in Metro Access that we wanted to discuss.
Well, let's see if we have questions on what we've just heard. No. Thank you very much. It was very, very well presented.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And what is the other issue?
The other item was mailed in the packet last Friday concerning Medicaid transportation in the district and the impact on Metro Access. And we had advised in that mailing that we were prepared to brief you on this if you'd like.
Definitely would like, so.
So with that, thank you very much. John, if you could get into this. Just want to give you a brief background on this issue. We had been discussing with the district since last June the notion that there might be some efficiencies and economic advantages to having Medicaid customers in the district use Metro services. And we have been having that discussion, I think, in earnest much more recently as certain decisions have been made to actually start moving some customers off of the Medicaid transportation system to Metro. Clearly, those customers that use bus and rail are going to have a great advantage, and I think Metro is more than willing and has been offering assistance with that transition process to help with that. And as Mr. Millis had mentioned earlier, part of what Access Services does is that we do provide and promote travel training to help people with disabilities use bus and rail. And I think in those modes, capacity is something that we think we can offer, and we believe that those modes offer the most independent method of travel for our customers. However, there were some customers who are not able to use bus and rail, as Mr. Graham had alluded to earlier. That's why we have paratransit service. But there is a difference between the specialized transportation services that a Medicaid system would offer beyond what ADA paratransit is here at Metro. Some of those customers receive attendant services. Someone rides along with them if they have medical needs and things of that nature. That's provided, and that is a different level of service than what ADA complementary paratransit service is meant to do. What has happened since we began those discussions is that there has been a movement of customers off of the district's Medicaid transportation program, and 900 individuals have been referred to Metro Access just within the last month for consideration to use our paratransit service. And as I'm sure everyone is aware, each application triggers our eligibility process. We have a medical review and then also an in-person functional assessment. And clearly that's a significant volume. The district's cost per trip to carry those customers on their system is approximately $17. But when those rides are transitioned to our paratransit system, assuming those customers are found to be eligible, our cost is more like $38 a trip, which does not include capital. And that doesn't even cover, again, some of the capacity issues and some of the special needs that those customers would have that Metro Access would not be capable of accommodating. And if those individuals take not only their medical trips on Metro Access, but once eligible, if they travel as often as a typical customer and they take on the average 9 trips a month, the total annual impact on our subsidy could exceed $4.1 million.
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Hudson.
Would you like to finish?
I think we've been informal, so go ahead.
I wanted to go to that last point. When you say that the Metro Access cost is $38 per trip, are you considering that the change in service part, or simply the comparable cost of how we deliver the service today versus how the service might need to be?
That's correct. $38 represents our current cost with our current service model.
And does that, do you, where do you take in consideration what changes might be, or is that part of the letter?
Well, I think it would be a larger policy discussion for the board's consideration if the service model changed and we were required to provide attendant services or other additional accommodations. We'd have to gauge what that cost would be.
Mr. Linton.
Let me just say a couple things, and I'm very interested in this, and there's significant issues here. Historically, there has always been an effort to move Medicaid transportation users to systems, to transit systems. However, most of that effort has been trying to get migrant people to fixed route systems with the idea that when you do that, the Health and Human Services costs are reduced. And I know when I was at FTA, there were a lot of models around the country where there were incentives to try to do that. And I know that there was a lot of savings that occurred as a result of that. However, when you're making a move that goes from the Medicaid-specific service with support and you make that transfer to the paratransit system, that's a different model and that's a different issue because the service expectations are different and the costs are different. So it ends up being a cost driver for the agency. And that's a whole different concern. And I think the other thing that you just mentioned is the service delivery impacts could be if you try to model your existing service on the service and even the expectations of the customers who are transitioning from one to the other, the cost impact would even be more significant. And those are costs that are not really eligible under the ADA kind of paratransit service that we currently provide. So this is a significant issue, and I just think we need to think about the impact.
Well, and I did want to just add one point, too, that even if a customer is found to be eligible under ADA, again, that additional assistance is another story. We would not say that if because that person needs additional assistance, they're not eligible. They absolutely are eligible. But then the question becomes, but where is the gap for that need being met?
Sure.
And we felt it was important to discuss this in the context of the upcoming budget year. But again, I think it was important for us to emphasize that we absolutely have embraced the transition to fixed route. There are a lot of things we can do, as you can see here on Next Steps. We talked about lending travel training assistance, and also even with our Smart Benefits program, it would be possible for the Medicaid office to send those benefits right into a card and let customers travel independently on the service, and we think that's a great idea, and we're certainly ready to assist.
Would be possible, but that was not part of the transition?
That's just an option. I mean, but they could obviously begin using fixed route service as soon as they felt they were able.
Wait a minute, let me go back to this.
That's an accounting.
When the discussions were about taking on the Medicaid users to our system, there was not a discussion of transitioning the money, the Medicaid support for that transportation? That didn't come with the individuals as well?
No.
I think your question is, we had discussions about the costs and the implications of the costs of those individuals moving to our system. But ultimately, there is a cost, a higher cost of this transition that will impact the subsidies that are required.
Yeah, I understand that the higher cost because of the nature of the service, but there is even
dollars.
Medicaid supports the transportation services with money that comes from HHS. In the transitioning to our system, even the fixed route, we didn't capture that money?
No, that hasn't been part of the discussion. It didn't carry that far. And that's one of the reasons why we wanted to talk about this today, was the idea that we discussed it conceptually, began to talk about ways that Metro could offer support. And then there was not much dialogue beyond that. And then most recently, within the last month, we started receiving the paratransit applications, and that's why we just felt that it was necessary to raise the point.
Who can I talk to?
Can we talk?
Yeah, I'm very interested in, I'm trying to be kind here, so I will be kind, and I'll refrain some, it's kind of like system dumping. There's transitioning that can occur, and as I said, there's always been a desire in the bigger policy framework of transitioning people from Medicaid to fixed route system. There was always also the thought, at least when we talked about it nationwide, was that the funding would therefore go from HHS to DOT or HHS funding services to DOT transportation services,
And it seemed to me that any, at least at the level of what they were receiving, that should have been sent over at the time. Not even talking about the additional services that may be required if the board went forward and said that we wanted to assign some additional support over and above what paratransit provides for the Medicaid recipients. But I can't understand how the baseline dollars didn't flow with the customer.
Well, one thing I could add, too, is just that we have had some dialogue with the Department of Transportation in the district, and I know that DDOT staff was intending to discuss this further with the city administrator's office, at least where the paratransit element was concerned.
What kind of notification did we get as to when this transition was going to occur?
I believe we got very little notification, and we did have discussions with the district officials or the managers there, telling them that this would increase the annual cost. And our recommendations to them is that we make the transition of those individuals who can use the fixed route and rail services, but that the district continues to offer the Medicaid services to those special need customers, particularly with the increase in ridership that we are experiencing on Metro Access and the impacts to the FY10 budget and the FY09 budgets. We don't get the monies from the Medicaid. It goes to those social service agencies. And when the individuals come to our system, that just increases our costs significantly. And we have communicated that it will require a large increase in subsidies, and we will continue those discussions. Our recommendations are that we work to transition those individuals who can use fixed route and rail. Our recommendation is also that it's more cost effective for the agency and the district to continue the special needs services is provided under Medicare.
Well, you know, our model does not lend itself to be able to accommodate those that need assistance. And I would hope that was discussed.
Mr. Graham, you chaired a committee in the council. Was there any, what's your thoughts on this? Any comments on?
Am I going to be asked questions? The questions all went this way.
Okay. Okay. Well, we do ask questions from ourselves from time to time.
But I think we have a. You're right, Mr. Linton, to raise the questions that you're raising because there are some broad impacts here.
Well, maybe I'll
just. If I may. And there is also budgetary impacts in terms of the District of Columbia, which concern me. And so may I suggest this, that we pause on this discussion for now, that we get additional materials. We need to consult with the Department of Transportation, the Department of Health, and our own Medicaid office, and put together a little bit more information on this for all of us, if we could do that.
Yeah, I mean, I actually think there you know, were some opportunities for some win-wins, but a lot of that had to do with how the transition took place and what steps were made to at least capture some of the money that is available out there that comes with HHS.
And also, there are questions about the D.C. Medicaid provider and the extent to which there's really been an appropriate transition. But I know enough about that to mention it, but I'd like to hold back a little bit for a fuller discussion.
If I may, Mr. Graham, I did want to just add very quickly just a few other items that even if we did receive some assistance from Medicaid.
Why don't we pause? I think we've decided to pause.
Yes, sir.
Okay? Because I think that from a fuller discussion on this really is merited, and I appreciate you bringing this to us.
Okay.
And if that's okay with Mr. Cato. We'll take this issue up again.
We will.
Let's agendize it for our next meeting, and we can have more full information.
Okay, and we will have efforts underway to work with the district, hopefully, to continue to provide the service.
Okay. Is there further discussion on Metro?
Just in that item, when you come back, that we have some clarity of how those services have been delivered and the cost relationships as to. But they're coming from and what they would receive in service as well as cost, because I think we really need to get the idea.
There's a lot of questions here. There really are. Okay. Further,
Mr. Chairman, before you proceed, I would like to get some, I know at the federal level there's a United We Ride, and there's the HHS DOT Coordinating Council. I'd like to kind of, raise this up a little bit too, to see how this relates to the migration and the integration of the services and the cost. I think this is a real good case study for that group to examine and look at the impacts on both sides on how that occurs. So I would request that our staff at least forwards that to that committee.
Okay. Is there further discussion on Metro Access? Let me just say that concludes. I do want to make a couple of closing comments. First, I noticed that our action items for October 2nd include the authorization of a public hearing to discontinue non-regional Metro bus routes in Fairfax County. This very same item, an authorization of a public hearing to discontinue routes, is to be found under the Finance Committee's jurisdiction. And so I don't know what the jurisdictional issue here is. I think these are both operational issues to cause a hearing. And so I just bring that to your attention, Mr. Cato, that there is an inconsistency here, which I didn't quite understand. I thought that the 98 was supposed to come before this committee, but you could look into that for us, couldn't you? And I just want to say in conclusion that once again, the Metro General Manager has reached on into the board delegation from the District of Columbia to hire somebody. I don't know how this will bode for Mr. Giancola and your humble self here, but we see that Mr. McAmonime, who was had a very distinguished career as a board member and as the Director of Transportation, his view is now obscured, but he is over there. And we do congratulate him on his advancement, and we miss him as a transportation director and also as my colleague here on the board. The mayor is intending to make a recommendation on this subject. And let me just say for those of you who follow these fine points, and there are probably not too many of you, but the board members from the District of Columbia are appointed by the Council of the District of Columbia. But we do take into account the mayor's recommendation on two of the members. But the appointment actually originates with the council under the law, similar to the situation in Virginia, which has an interesting appointment process. But we were expecting that appointment to be announced, and maybe even be announced today or tomorrow. And so but I do wanted to acknowledge the presence of McAmonime here in a different position than he has been, and I want to wish him well with his work. And I think that concludes the business of this committee. Does it?
Yes, it does. I was just going to follow into that. We're very happy to have him on board, as well as Carol Kissel, who is our new chief financial officer. And while there is some, you made comments about the general manager reaching into the district. I'm following the instructions given to me when I was hired to hire the smartest, the brightest, and the best people you can find.
Good. Well, there are a lot of smart and bright people left on the board, fortunately. I might be looking for work. But that's another issue, isn't it, Mr. Linton?
That's in my resume.
Yeah. That must be enough for us. So we are now going to turn this over to the Finance Committee. This meeting of the Customer Service Operations and Safety Committee is adjourned.